one of the most comfortable settings I've seen in my travels in the last 2 months. I'm going to tell you today about a new search strategy for Axion Dark Matter, just using optical interferometry and a special kind of cavity that has birefringence between two orthogonal polarizations. Please stop me at any time to ask questions. Just as an introduction, I also spent a lot of time thinking about cosmological signatures of energy injection from dark matter annihilation or decay. So if you're interested to talk about that as well, please come look for me. I'm somewhere on the second floor. Okay. So I'm just going to run through very quickly what I'm going to talk to you about in this talk. First, I'm going to give you a very pictorial understanding of what axions do to light. In particular, we'll look at some of the electromagnetic equations that go into why axions have some kind of non-classical effect on light propagation, just a very simple understanding of what that does to propagating light. And then I will go into a very brief crash course of optical cavities and all of the things that you need to know about cavities to understand how our experiment's going to work. And then I'll dive right in into the experiment itself, which we call the axion detection with birefringent cavities experiment, or ADBC. We'll conclude. Okay, so let's go right in. First of all, I probably don't need to spend too much time telling you about the QCD axion. It was proposed originally to explain the strong CP problem, which is the situation where you measure the neutron EDM and you find that it's unnaturally small compared to what you might naively expect in the standard model. And the solution is to essentially make the theta parameter of QCD dynamical by introducing a new field A called the axion. Not sure why I'm holding this hockey stick if there's a laser pointer, but I think I'll go with the laser pointer. Yeah.
We time all the speakers to see how long it takes.
It's good in theory, but it gets kind of heavy. Yeah. So the point, is to make the theta parameter of QCD dynamical, and this turns out to be, in the end, also a good dark matter candidate, ending up as a cold, coherent, oscillating scalar field at late times in the universe. Due to QCD effects, when you introduce this dynamical theta field A, you always also end up getting this coupling to AFF dual of electromagnetism. This immediately opens up a whole range of experiments trying to detect deviations from classical ENM that arise from this term right here. Just as a note, throughout this talk, I will loosely refer to the particle that we're looking for as axion or axion dark matter. So the first thing that I should make sure to point out is that we're looking for a dark matter candidate. Any kind of axion-like particle that is dark matter and is present, sort of everywhere in our experiment is a good candidate that we're looking for. The other thing that I should emphasize is that we're looking for axion-like particles. So any particle that has this coupling, and it need not necessarily be the QCD axion where there is a relationship between the coupling constant here and the mass. So we don't only target the QCD axion here. The other thing that I want to mention here is that our experimental size is always going to be smaller than the axion wavelength, and so we can always treat the axion field as spatially coherent. Okay, so with that, let's talk about what axions do to light. So if there was no AFF dual term that you saw earlier in the previous slide, then that's just the usual classical ENM. And if you ask, what are the eigenmodes of free propagation for light? What does light do as it propagates? It turns out that you can basically just the usual solution where you have two different polarizations Here we take horizontal and vertical, and then you have all these modes of fixed frequency. So as light propagates in space, they stay in one of these eigenmodes, and they are completely, orthogonal to each other. What the axion does is it introduces a coupling between some of these modes. So if you look at this coupling, this term here, interaction term here, and you write it in terms of the fields, you get something that looks like A, E dot B. And if you look at the two different polarizations, you have one polarization that has E in the horizontal, another in the with the B field in the horizontal. And what the axion does is it causes mixing between a mode that is at, for example, a frequency omega naught with horizontal polarization, with two modes in the vertical polarization that are separated by the axion mass. So just saying it again, axions allow transitions between what we would normally think of as orthogonal polarizations, orthogonal eigenstates, and they allow these transitions between modes that are separated by the axion mass. Okay? So physically, what happens? So you look at a photon with frequency omega naught. It travels through space, and it goes through, in the presence of axion dark matter, this photon will then be able to mix into these orthogonal polarizations. So here, we start off with some light in the horizontal polarization. As it propagates in time, some of the energy goes into vertically polarized modes here, given by omega naught plus minus ma. And then this kind of oscillates along with the coherent oscillations of axions. Okay, a more physical picture maybe is to look at the polarization vector. So if you look at the light beam as it propagates, if you initially start off with some horizontal polarization, as it propagates in the axion field, this polarization will wiggle slightly, so it will go up a little bit, back to horizontal, and then down a little bit in horizontal. And so it develops a small vertical polarization. And this is just a different way of illustrating this in a more physical way. In terms of circular polarizations, this is also very interesting. If you take two circularly polarized light beams, one left-handed and the other one right-handed, you get them to go along in space. They end up having oscillating differing phase velocities. So as they propagate, some of them, one of the polarizations goes ahead and then eventually goes behind and so on. Okay, so the whole point of this is that, without the axion, none of these things would happen. And if you want to detect the axion, what you want to do is you want to maximize this non-classical ENM behavior to detect. Right, you want to detect these non-classical behaviors to show that axions are present. One of the most efficient ways that we have of looking for deviations in electromagnetism that we have developed over the last century or so is interferometry. And in fact, it was first deployed in the Michelson-Morley experiment to test for test for exactly classical ENM behavior, and then subsequently used in all kinds of experiments up all the way up till LIGO today. And the point is, interferometry is a very sensitive technique that can really, accentuate some of these non-classical or, slight deviations from the usual behavior that you're expecting. And one of the most standard optical tools that are in use in these experiments is the laser cavity, which I'm now going to give you a quick introduction to. Okay, so what follows is a poor particle physicist's cookbook for optical cavities. I am a terrible experimentalist. And say it again? Yeah, that's right. So before starting, this project, my only experience was from an optics class when I was a junior, and we were doing fun things like, measuring the width of your hair with lasers and so on. So I knew very little about optics prior to this project. So the bare minimum that I know I'm just going to show you on these slides, and hopefully that's going to help us understand the kind of optics that's necessary to get to the ADBC experiment. Okay, so like I said, the main tool that we're going to focus on is the cavity, the optical cavity, or usually called the Fabry-Perot cavity. And what this is just two mirrors. One mirror, which is slightly less than perfect, so you get it to as high a reflectivity as you can, just enough so that some of the laser light can actually couple in. And then on the other end, you try to get a mirror that's perfect. And what's going to happen as light couples into the cavity? So some of it gets transmitted in to the cavity, and it's going to start off here with some phase. Just as a note, throughout this talk, I draw circles with an arrow in it. Sometimes it represents phase. Sometimes it represents polarization. So in this case, we're going to look at phase. And so what happens is it's going to travel down the cavity over a distance L. At the end, it's going to pick up some phase as it propagates over this distance L. It's going to get reflected off the perfect mirror, and it's going to pick up a phase difference of pi after the reflection. And then it's going to travel all the way back to the start of the cavity again, again picking up the same EI k0L phase. And then it gets reflected off the mirror, where it picks up this reflectivity coefficient R here. Okay, so you do one complete round trip and you come back. Initially, you started off with ET. Now you're at ET R to the EI 2 k0L. In other words, you're off by some phase. And of course, there's this coefficient here, R. Okay, so you do this multiple times. As the light goes back and forth, you get some kind of superposition of fields along this mirror. And that's going to be given by ET times some phase and times some reflection coefficient R, and then the square of that, and so on, as it travels back and forth. As you might know from basic optics, when you take this, you notice that it's a geometric progression, so you can just sum it up like this. And so what you get is an expression for the field at this mirror, which is just given by the initial transmitted field divided by this factor here. So if you don't choose your laser wavelength, or if you don't choose the cavity length with any care, then what's going to happen is at this point here, the fields are all going to have different phases. And in general, this is not going to be anything special. But if you do happen to choose k0L to be n pi, then what's going to happen is the light is going to come back, and it's going to come back at the same phase. And you're going to get a coherent buildup of the field at this point. And so you're going to get a very large buildup of field that we call ECAF. And this is just going to be ET over this thing, 1 minus R. Here, remember, we're going to choose a mirror that is going to be very reflective. In that case, R is going to be very close to 1. And ET over 1 minus R is going to be a very large number. Okay, so we're going to build up the field this way. All right. Throughout this talk, I'm going to refer to something called the finesse. That's just a word that characterizes, that is the main figure of merit for the cavity. And essentially, the more reflective both of your mirrors are, the larger this figure of merit, or the larger the finesse. So what exactly is finesse? There are three different ways to understand what finesse is. The first is that the finesse tells you what the gain of the cavity field is with respect to the input field at resonance. Okay, so F is this quantity that we call finesse. And it turns out that in some particular definitions of F, this ET over 1 minus R thing can also be rewritten as F over pi. And so if your finesse F is very large, and this happens when your mirrors are very reflective, then what's going to happen is your ECAV is going to be many orders of magnitude larger than your initial transmitted field. Okay, so a large finesse, high finesse cavity gives you a large gain in the cavity field. What the finesse also tells you is it tells you how many times the light beam actually stays in the cavity. So roughly, if the finesse is 10,000, let's say, that means light on average stays in the cavity and bounces back and forth 10,000 times before most of it goes out through this mirror. So that's another way in which you can understand finesse. And probably the most sort of correct definition of what finesse is really telling you something about how narrow the resonance of the cavity is. So remember, you have to tune your cavity in such a way that your wave number times the length of the cavity is equal to n pi. And if you're slightly off this tuning, then you're not going to get as good of a resonance. And how off you can be is really defined also by this finesse thing. So the definition of the finesse really is that if you take the width of the resonance divided by the distance between resonances, then that's going to tell you what the finesse is. Okay, so if it's, for example, 10 to the 6, that means that the width between, it's the distance between resonances divided by the width. And so 10 to the 6 means that your width is 10 to the 6 times smaller than the distance between resonances. So all three of these definitions are equivalent, and they help you understand what's going on with the cavity sort of in three different ways. Okay? All right. So with that quick crash course, now we're ready to understand how this experiment works. Okay, so as was suggested, we're going to make use of a cavity. We call this experiment the ADBC experiment. And this is a cute logo that was designed by Jesse. And you can see the laser comes in and hits the mirrors A, D, B, and then C. And so this is the basic layout of our experiment. And if you look at it, it's actually the determinant of a 2x2 matrix given by these entries. Okay, sorry.
It's not rendering very well on the screen, but we can see it on your.
Oh right, yeah. Okay. So before I go into our experiment itself, let me just make sure to point out that there has already been some work on such experiments where you make use of interferometry to look for axions. This was done by Anton Hook and DeRocco earlier in February, and then another group in Japan, Obata et al. In May. So you might be wondering, you know, if these guys have already come up with experimental designs, why do we even bother, you know, doing more work? So these designs are all groundbreaking conceptual work. They focus on using circularly polarized light. So remember when I told you about how circularly polarized light behaves in the presence of axions? As they propagate, they develop a phase velocity difference. And the point of these experiments is to maximize that phase velocity difference. The reason why we thought there was still room for a better experimental design was that these two experiments have a much poorer axion mass reach. And in general, you know, they both involve cavities of some sort, and all of them are restricted to axion masses of less than 1 over the finesse times the length of the cavity. Okay, so because the finesse that you want to have in these experiments tend to be very big, like a million, for example, you're generally restricted to very low axion masses. And so one of the things that
the range, you mean?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The range of masses.
Yeah, the range.
The mass that mm-hmm. you are sensitive to is the length, right? 1/length.
Yeah, so these experiments are actually sensitive to 1/f times the length.
In mass.
Yeah.
And why? Yes. Why is that?
Because right. So what you want to do? Okay, if I go back to this picture. So what they're actually trying to do is they're trying to sit on a resonance.
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah.
That is centered at a frequency of 0, basically. So essentially, what they're doing is they're trying to build a cavity that is resonant at MA equals 0 with a width that is very, very small. So they're actually doing an experiment in a limit where MA is zero.
Oh, in the continuum, they're not looking for an oscillating effect?
They are, but their experiment is most sensitive in the limit that MA goes to zero.
So in order to not have to tune like a radio, they just go on zero and then work off the width that they worked really hard to make tiny.
So, yes,
so
exactly.
Why is that? Yeah. So the question is, why can't you be, I mean, I guess this is what you guys are doing. You're creating experiments sensitive to 1/L.
Yes.
Okay, so basically you're creating a way. So what are they missing here that they cannot flip the polarization properly when they in each reflection?
So later on you will realize that these experiments are a special case of our experiment. So our experiment allows us to tune allows us to tune the resonance of the cavity so that you're sensitive to different MAs. And in one particular configuration of our cavity, you're actually sensitive to MA equals zero. And that is exactly equivalent to these experiments.
No, I'll tell you my confusion here. Mm-hmm. I just don't understand the factor of 1/F where it's coming from.
Good. So roughly speaking, they have designed a cavity that is resonant at the point where MA equals zero.
So what happens? Can you explain? So in this cavity, so there is the you have circular polarized light that comes in.
Yeah, good.
The axis is oscillating.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say it's oscillating at some frequency MA, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there is like once the guy is ahead and then the other guy is ahead, it goes like that.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So what if you tune it so that when by the time you if MA is 1/L, then it takes, by the time the other, so in, can you flip properly the by properly scatter, you understand, right?
What yes,
going with this?
That's exactly the point. We want to be able to control the flipping, right?
Okay,
yeah.
So here, what are they missing that?
So they can't
control, are they canceling it out? Basically?
They can't control the flipping here. For example, in Anson's case, you put a quarter wave plate in a mirror, right?
Yeah.
So the phase difference that you get is just zero. That's the only phase difference that it can have, right? So what you're saying is you want like circularly polarized light coming in, right? And you want to somehow so initially you have this, let's say, and then you have another mirror here, and you want so that at this point there's a slight difference, right?
Exactly.
And then you want to cancel out this difference.
No, you don't want to cancel out. You want it to add up. So that at the end you get the maximum phase separation between the two polarization, right? You don't want to cancel this difference.
So what you want is, so my claim is that by controlling what phase difference you get here. So, let me just go into a simple case in Anson's case, right? Here, the phase difference that they introduce here is zero.
So it's always
zero.
That means that what happens after reflection? This is what I want to see.
After reflection in Anson's case,
the
phase difference is preserved, right?
Okay, why is that bad?
That's not bad. But it means that because the phase difference that you chose here is zero, it turns out that you are most sensitive to MA goes to zero. Because your cavity is tuned to be resonant. Essentially, it's tuned to be resonant at if I look
so,
at.
So what happens? I'm still confused. So let's say so when it reflects, the guy going this way is still ahead.
Yeah, it's still ahead.
So then, as you go to the other mirror, what happens?
They also have delta phi equals zero, right?
So what does that mean for the polarization? So after it reflects, does it mean that the one guy is ahead by two, twice the
yes, the, yeah, that's right.
But the effects adds up. So why is that bad?
The effect adds up, but you also need to remember that the cavity must be in resonance.
Yeah, so it goes like 2 MA times L.
Yes. So Okay. So the point is, let's see.
So the overall phase difference, what I'm saying is that if it adds up, then that means that when delta phi, so when you measure the phase difference between the guy that goes like that and the guy that goes like that,
yes.
then it's 2 times m times the number of turns times L.
Yeah. So the phase
okay, times n, though.
The phase difference between like left and right goes like this.
Times n, though.
Times finesse, basically.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
So number of reflections.
That's right.
Okay.
But the electric field that you get here, the cavity electric field,
yeah,
E cav, turns out to be proportional to 1 over something like square root 1 minus 2 malr plus r squared. So as you build the, I think if I go into our design, it would be easier to explain this, because in this case,
but then yeah. Delta phi, you interfere the light outside. You don't measure the field inside, right?
You don't measure the field inside, but the fact that you are paying this price means that the signal that you build up actually goes down. So the output signal here is actually smaller. As MA goes away from zero.
That's not clear. Okay.
I think it's not clear because the thing that's making it confusing is the circular polarizations.
Okay.
But if I switch to a linear polarization, it becomes much clearer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I claim so far that these experiments are sensitive to. Essentially, the MA equals zero limit. And also, they have some very non-trivial experimental challenges that need to be overcome. So one thing for example, Anton's design here has 2 beams. And this causes differences in radiation pressure on each mirror. And this causes a radiation pressure noise. And it turns out you don't actually need 2 beams to do these experiments. You just really need 1. And actually, these guys figured out that, you know, in essence, you only need 1 beam. But the problem with this setup is that they're trying to put in circularly polarized light into this thing called a bow tie cavity. And it turns out that circularly polarized light is they're not eigenmodes of a bow tie cavity. So as they propagate in here, they actually start getting elliptical almost immediately. So this setup actually doesn't really work either, unless you're somehow able to preserve circular polarization in the cavity, which is in general just very hard. So let me just continue and just remind you again, what we want to do is we have light traveling and you have these oscillations, these mixings into orthogonal polarizations. And the splitting here is given by plus minus MA. So the strategy of our experiment is to, again, now we're going to start with horizontally polarized light. So we're not going to use circularly polarized light, so linear polarization. You put in horizontally polarized light at some kind of carrier frequency given by omega naught. So you shine a very bright laser at omega naught, put it into the Fabry-Perot cavity. And then as it builds in the cavity, you want to make sure that your cavity is resonant at this carrier frequency here, omega naught. And also resonant at omega naught plus or minus MA in the vertical polarization, so that as the field bounces back and forth in the cavity, you also get a buildup of the signal here that is resonant. Okay, so that's the strategy. Find some kind of cavity that is resonant in omega naught in the horizontal and omega naught minus MA in the vertical. So in other words, we need a cavity. That turns out to be birefringent between horizontal and vertical polarization. Okay, so going back to Anson's design, which is essentially just 2 mirrors like that with a quarter wave plate. okay? And you want the laser to go in like that. And so when the laser reflects off each of these surfaces, the angle of incidence is zero. And it turns out that if the angle of incidence is zero, if you put in two different polarizations, because the angle of incidence is zero, you get no birefringence, and you get no phase difference. You get no difference in behavior between both polarizations. And again, the claim is that in this case, you are limited in sensitivity to m equals to zero. And I will try to explain this later on. Okay.
Could you just explain the orientation of the blue arrows and the blue bars?
Yes.
Physically signified.
Yeah. So these arrows here are polarization. So you have something in the horizontal polarization, and these bars are just energy.
So blue things are just showing that those are vertically polarized, but I don't take any units in the direction of those.
No. Arrows. Yeah. Okay. All right. So you want to build a cavity that's birefringent in two different polarizations that has resonances at two different frequencies. And that sounds difficult, but actually, birefringence is quite a normal phenomenon in optics. So for example, one very well-known example is the Brewster's angle. So if you put in light with two different polarizations here, and you let it reflect off an angle of incidence between air and glass, such that this angle here, after reflection and refraction, if this angle here is 90 degrees, then what's going to happen is none of the polarization that happens in the plane actually gets reflected off. So you get a completely polarized beam of light coming out from the surface if you happen to have an angle of incidence given by Brewster's angle. And this happens because essentially at this interface here, you have a bunch of dipoles that are lined up this way, and they're trying to radiate by oscillating in this direction. And the only way that it can transmit this polarization is in this direction and not in this direction. And so you automatically get birefringence just from oblique reflection. Right, so and before I go on, this is something that's been very well known within, even in the field of photography. So if you want to take a photo and you're trying to capture a photo of a glass surface, for example, if you want to try to reduce the amount of reflection that's coming off the glass surface, what you can do is you can use a polarizing filter to try to filter out predominant polarization that gets reflected off into the camera. And so by rotating a polarizing filter, you can also control how much of the light from reflection you see on the surface. So this is not surprising at all. And it's governed by classical optics, and in particular, something called the Fresnel equations. More generally, anytime you have an oblique reflection, you introduce a phase difference between orthogonal linear polarizations. So every time you reflect off a surface, if you send something in that's in phase, after the reflection, you get some phase difference here between horizontal and vertical. Okay, so what we want to do is we just have to basically design a cavity that makes use of oblique reflections instead of normal reflections, like in Anson's case. And what you're going to get is you're going to get phase differences between the two polarizations at each of these reflection points, at A, D, B, and C. All right? So before I go on, let me return to this thing about Anson's design versus this. If you think in terms of linear polarization, you're going to get light that is, let's say, horizontal polarized, and it's going to propagate. And as it propagates, it's going to rotate a little bit. Mm-hmm. Okay. In Anson's original design, if I go back to that slide, imagine if these were linearly polarized light. As it propagates, it's going to rotate a little bit, right?
Yeah.
And as it goes up and down in the cavity, it's going to rotate more and more.
Yeah.
And because of the quarter wave plate, this rotation builds.
Yes. Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. The rotation builds. But if we ask, what is the field that's going to build up in the cavity? It's going to be this, and then slightly a little bit off, and a slightly a little bit off. So you're not on resonance. And you're only exactly on resonance when MA goes to zero.
Okay.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So they do have a coherent buildup of the phase, but their cavity is designed to only be resonant at MA goes to zero. And so the difference here is that we have a cavity that we can adjust the phase difference at all of these points. And so...
So that you flip the polarization such a way so that the field adds up as well.
Yes, exactly. So you not only have the rotations that are building as they propagate, but every time they return in phase. And so you get a build-up as well in the signal. And that's the key difference here. Okay, so if that was not clear, I will go through slowly how this ADBC experiment works. Okay, so again, let me just be very clear about what I mean by arrows in circles.
Sorry,
yes.
I'm still a bit confused.
Yeah.
The reason it has to do with, because you don't care how much field, if you were to measure how much field is, so let's say you have predominantly one polarization, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now you add up a polarization like that.
Mm-hmm.
The point is, though, that if you have a little angle here,
yep.
Most of these guys still on the direction of this guy. It's just theta squared less.
Yes.
But
you're trying to detect the other
guy.
Yeah. So as you rotate, you're trying to detect this polarization, right? And because you haven't, because it's coming back like this, like this, like this, like this.
Yeah, it's only linear in theta.
Yeah.
So there's no way. So the guy that is pointing upwards. So let's say you have some field outside,
mm-hmm.
and then the guy that's pointing out interferes with the guy that's coming out of the cavity. So for the guy that's pointing up, there's mm-hmm. no phase difference, basically. This is what you're saying. So you only have, you can only see the effect of the action if you measure the field that's perpendicular.
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
And you want that to be in phase as well. That's the point.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, so basically, like, if they don't put a quarter wave plate, but like a little bit less than quarter wave plate, then it's the same thing.
Exactly. So one way that you can understand our experiment through Anson's design is if your quarter wave plate can have controllable phase changes, then yes,
that's fine.
Yes.
The design is going to be such that you can adjust the angles of these so that the phase rotation introduced by the axion is exactly canceled every time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly that. Yes. Exactly that. Yes. Yeah. So yeah, if you could do that with a quarter wave plate that isn't lossy and
that's
you could
valuable.
Control it, yeah.
Yeah.
Then sure.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. But yeah, the point here is you don't actually need quarter wave plates. Quarter wave plates are not great optical devices because they're very lossy and it limits the kind of finesse that you can get in your cavity. You can just do it with mirrors. Okay. So just to be clear for everyone, I'm just going to go through slowly how this experiment works. Again, arrows now are indicating phase, and colors are indicating polarizations. So here I inject a carrier frequency at omega naught with a horizontal polarization with some initial phase given arbitrarily by this arrow. Okay. So what's going to happen is it's going to propagate in the cavity. It's going to reach the other end. Remember, in the presence of axions, you're going to get this mixing into the other orthogonal polarizations. So by the time it reaches the other end, you have some small amount of signal in the vertical component. And these two, remember that this vertical component is at a frequency given by omega naught plus or minus MA. So here, at this point, the phase difference is going to be different. Okay? It's going to undergo two reflections. So at the end of two reflections, it's going to come out. Again, each reflection has a different phase difference, introduces a different phase difference between the horizontal and the vertical. So you're going to come back out with something that looks like this. And then it's just going to complete a round trip. OK, sorry. So at the end of the round trip, you have you've developed some kind of signal, but it's off phase, and also your carrier is off phase. And remember, you want to build you essentially want to build a cavity where this guy and this guy are in phase. Okay, so what you do is you adjust the laser frequency slightly. First of all, so if you do a slight adjustment of the laser frequency, what's going to happen is you can come back in phase for the carrier polarization, which is the horizontal polarization. So now they're in phase. And then what you want to do is you want to bring the other signal polarization, which is that omega naught plus MA, into phase as well. And you can do that because by adjusting the angle of incidence at each of these mirrors, you can adjust the phase difference at the end of each of these pair of reflections, here and here. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to shift the mirrors slightly. And as we shift the mirrors, eventually, if MA corresponds to the, you know, if, for example, 2 times MAL corresponds to the phase difference introduced here at these two reflections and here, then it will also come into resonance here, and you would have a large buildup in the signal as well.
But does that mean you have to do it? How do you do that? Do you actually move them physically?
Yeah, you have to move the mirrors.
But how fast?
How fast? I mean, you move the mirrors, and you take the signal, and you integrate that over some amount of time, right?
Yeah, this is what I don't understand. So mm-hmm. What frequencies are you thinking about for the action here?
Oh,
I want to understand what does it mean for?
Yeah, so the kind of axion frequencies mass that we're looking at is basically order 1 of L, right? So
every 1 over L you have to flip that?
Oh, no. So in practice, what's going to happen is you build the cavity, you know, like if I set my mirrors at this angle,
yeah.
I would get resonance at some axion mass.
Oh, I see.
And then,
I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay. So how does the resonance frequency and the angle are related? How are they related? So it's 1 over L times something.
Yeah. So what you want is essentially the horizontal and vertical, as they propagate along the long side of this cavity, they develop a phase difference of MAL, right?
Yeah.
And then what you want is you need the phase difference introduced here and here, delta phi, to cancel out MAL. So MAL would be equal to delta phi on this side. And then you want the same thing on this side. And so by controlling the angle, if you know what the angle is, you know what delta phi is, and then you know where you're resonant at for the axion mass.
Okay.
Okay, so it turns out that you can do this pretty easily. You don't have to worry about the path length changing. In other words, you can keep this beam here and this beam here almost along the same path if you adjust these mirrors like a retroreflector. So as long as they maintain a slightly less than 90 degree angle, if they rotate like that, then these two beams will always be transmitted along the same path. So it's very easy. You just take the two mirrors and you rotate them rigidly together. And as you rotate, you adjust the angle of incidence here. And by doing that, you sweep through a range of MAs. Okay. So as I was saying, the resonance is achieved for the signal polarization when the phase difference that you get from these two oblique reflections, delta phi, cancels the phase difference due to propagation, MAL. And so if this is in resonance at omega naught, then this would be in resonance at omega naught plus MA as well. Okay. So all you have to do is characterize your mirror properties as well as possible. Okay, so by rotating the mirrors, it allows us to scan over a broad range of axion masses. As I said again, in the original designs, essentially what you're trying to do is you're trying to have delta phi of 0 at each of these ends using the quarter wave plates. But now by rotating the mirrors, you can scan over axion masses, and this improves reach from previous designs, which were limited to 1 over f times l.
So what are you measuring exactly?
Yeah, good. I'll come to that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. So now our mass reach is independent of finesse. And like I said, you want a high finesse for large signals. And so this is much better than the previous reaches. Okay, so just a quick digression. Well, not really a digression, but like a comparison between what's happening in the optical case versus what's happening in the microwaves case. Essentially, we're doing exactly the same thing. We're exploiting the same AFF tilde operator. But in the case of the optical, the ADBC experiment, we're trying to transition from some omega naught up to omega naught plus minus MA. And for the ADMX experiment, they are starting from a DC field and trying to transition up to a frequency at MA. And the signal power stored really scales almost identically to what's happening in the ADMX experiment as well. So it scales linearly with the volume, and it scales with the quality factor of the cavity, and as well as the field value squared. Okay. The other thing that I also want to point out is you can make your cavity resonant at omega naught plus MA, but you can also make it resonant at omega naught minus MA. And if you have a single axion that's responsible for the resonance at both points, then you would see a signal in both cases, even though they correspond to completely different mirror configurations. So this is one very useful check that you can do to confirm any kind of signals. Okay, so now let's talk about what kind of signals we're trying to read out. So the way that we do this readout, you know, naively, what you would want to do is you would want to just say, okay, if I put in horizontal polarization into the cavity without an axion, the only thing that's going to come out is a horizontally polarized light. So what you want to do really is to just try to filter out this horizontal polarization and look for the vertical. You can do that, but then your signal ends up being proportional to the coupling squared. And so this is a very, very small effect that you're looking for. And so the actual approach that we want to do is just called heterodyne detection, which is probably known to many of you. What we want to do is we want to try to mix a little bit of the carrier polarization into the signal. And in so doing, you end up with you will end up looking for a signal that is proportional to G, A gamma gamma instead. So if this is the output that you get from your cavity here, it looks something like that. And what we're going to do is we're going to try to have a polarizer that is tilted slightly off from the vertical with some small angle epsilon. And what you're going to do, what you're going to see at the end is that the power that's going to be transmitted along this axis scales as epsilon times the carrier plus the signal squared. And so essentially what you're looking for is you're looking for some kind of AC signal that comes from the fact that a carrier and signal are going to beat against each other, and you're going to get some power component that scales as MAT. And importantly, it's also proportional to E times the carrier. And so by doing this, you will see something that's proportional to GA gamma gamma instead.
Oh.
Yeah, it's the polarization angle here. OK? Yeah.
So now you're limited to how well you can constrain, keep the carrier stable.
Say it again?
I mean, it depends on how well you can keep the carrier stable.
Yes. Yeah, good. Yes. So you might be worried that your carrier can also wander like this.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. So that turns out to limit how low you can go in terms of axion mass, and I'll describe that a bit later.
So, naively speaking, if there's no signal, would you not still now get a tiny readout? Oh, sorry, AC only.
Yeah, so you won't get this, so you won't get a beating. Yep.
Gotcha.
Okay. So, how do we get our sensitivity estimate? We turn to the signal-to-noise ratio, and we just estimate our reach to be what happens when the signal-to-noise ratio is 1. And in this case, the signal-to-noise ratio turns out to be just directly proportional to the AC power that we saw earlier from heterodyne detection, and it scales as long as you're integrating below the coherence time of the axion, then it scales as the integration time to the half.
Sorry, I'll ask you a very dumb question now. Sorry. So you were saying that in the previous case, in Anson's case, you still had the buildup of in perpendicular direction, right?
Yeah.
So why couldn't you do the same trick in Anson's case, do the heterodyne trick and just detect it?
You can. You can.
But then you become sensitive to one over L. So why do you need the bow tie?
Oh, no, no, no. So, okay.
So you were saying here, right?
Uh-huh.
If I understood correctly.
Yes.
So you're saying as the thing, so at the input mirror, let's say, the field just goes like that a little bit.
Yeah.
So the field that is like this is still proportional to the phase shift theta. Off axis. So the question is, if I were to somehow change to the heterodyne thing and put some of the carrier signal, then I still have an effect that's linear to theta without canceling.
Sorry, I didn't quite get that. So here
in cavity
is
in what direction?
It is in the carrier direction.
Okay, so that means that there is okay. So that means that the carrier direction, so you have something that goes like that. So basically the carrier starts off like this.
Sorry, no. Wait, I think I'm confused. Sorry, no.
Yeah.
The thing that I wrote here is the signal.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
So the signal is in what direction here?
So
how does the
So let's say vertical, right?
Yeah. So it's like this.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, why can't you just use the heterodyne trick here?
You can.
Oh.
You can, but the field itself, even before the heterodyne detection, right?
Yeah.
The signal field itself is already down by this factor in the setup. This is independent of the detection scheme, right? So the detection scheme doesn't change what E signal is, right? It only just changes how we read it out, that's all. Whether you choose this way of reading out,
this is what I'm saying. Why can't you just do the...
You can, but my claim is that in Anson's case, the signal field itself, even before we do the detection, is already down.
The part that I'm missing, so I still don't understand that.
Okay.
So here you have circularly polarized light, though. That's the tricky part.
Yeah, but it's so two circular polarizations equivalent to just thinking of one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So one. So that means that if I were to measure, let's say that I have a perfectly like the circle that you have there.
Yeah.
It means that my whole field is just rotating.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So then I project in the sine theta and project in the perpendicular axis. So then the signal is still proportional to the phase shift. So if
it's proportional, it is proportional to phase shift, but there are two things, right? You want the phase shift to build, but you also want the field to build.
This is the part that I'm missing.
Yeah.
So I understand the phase it builds, and I'm saying that in the perpendicular direction, then it's linear in the coupling.
Mm-hmm.
For the field, forget about how you measure it.
Yeah.
This factor, I don't understand where it's coming from then.
Right.
Because if the whole field is just shifting around, so you can think about the whole thing as just making a rotation.
Mm-hmm.
So then I have most of the carrier field still in this direction, but I have a little like strong perpendicular. Where does that factor come in?
Because so let's see. Okay, so you have the horizontal carrier, right?
Yeah.
So the horizontal carrier goes back and forth.
Yeah.
And you tune your cavity so that it is resonant in the carrier.
Yeah.
Right? But now you have the signal, which is in the vertical.
Yeah.
And as it goes, one round trip, and it comes back, because your axion is doing this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the vertical starts off at, essentially the vertical component comes back at, let me try to explain this again. So you have a carrier, right? Let's say in the horizontal.
Okay.
And we look at the phase. Okay. At the end of one round, at the end of one round trip, it comes back in phase.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So your carrier is on resonance.
Okay. Perfect.
Now your signal.
Yeah.
In Anson's case, the carrier and the signal are in phase because there's no phase difference developed at each reflection.
Okay.
So when your signal comes back, remember your signal is at omega naught plus MA, whereas your carrier is at omega naught. So when your signal comes back, the phase is all off.
I see what you're saying. They missed the part that there is this.
And it would not be, it would all be in phase if MA goes to zero. So that's where they're most sensitive.
So E equals each one of those added up, and then you square it when you're actually doing it at a little space time point. But because you're actually reading out something like 10,000 photons that have bounced.
That's right.
At any one time, you want them all to be in phase. You're actually doing the readout at the edge of the experiment.
Correct.
You'll get the largest signal.
Correct.
So something I was worried about in your setup is like, their setup is such that, you know, my background is on resonance. Their sort of background null signal is, their background null observation would be on resonance because you would just have you would just have it bouncing back and forth in like no phase shift throughout the experiment.
Yeah.
Whereas in your case, the background readout or something that would be like a non-observation of axions would be off resonance, and you know you put the signal now on resonance. But is the reason you're doing this heterodyne readout structure because you need some way to tell that the laser is actually going through and doing what you expect to begin with? Or in other words, if I reframed it in terms of their setup, I guess what I'm asking is why even do this heterodyne setup? Why not just look for a signal?
So,
because
the power scales is as g squared in this case. So just to be clear, even though Anson didn't say it, the fact that they took all of the, essentially they took all of the gravitational waves mechanism and imported it over, right? So even though he didn't say it explicitly, they're also relying on a heterodyne detection. So actually, it's not different.
Okay.
Here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. This is what I want to see. Okay, but the point is that you're saying because there's this MA difference, it just doesn't add up. You need to make it resonant at MA times. Yeah. Okay, continue. I'm still a bit confused. But
okay.
Continue.
Yeah. To be honest, we took a month to boil it down to actually just the fact that you want the signal to be in phase as well. And after we realized that, it was like, oh, okay, it makes much more sense. But we were very confused for a very long time. We do this heterodyne scheme thing. So I just want to point out that the noise that we have, at least in our setup, at the moment, is still dominated by short noise.
Yeah.
And this is just Poisson fluctuation in the power of the laser. And then the other thing that we want to point out is if you integrate past the coherence time, then your signal-to-noise ratio scales as t times the coherence time to the 1/4. And so your signal-to-noise ratio doesn't improve arbitrarily well after if you're measuring above the axion coherence time. Okay. Now our sensitivity limits. So remember, our sensitivity is set predominantly by short noise. You might be worried about a couple of other noise sources. So the first one is if your laser is not stable enough, right? So if your laser is, you want to put in a horizontal carrier laser, but if your laser wanders a little bit in like the vertical, then you might end up seeing, you know, some effect in the vertical that may look like a signal. It turns out that we can control the frequency at which this wandering of the laser, the laser technical noise, all the way down to about 100 hertz or so. And so beyond this point where you go into lower and lower frequencies, we feel that we don't have as good of a control.
What level can you control that frequency? So, fractionally.
So we believe we can hold it to be below short noise. down to about this frequency here at about 10 hertz.
It's about what? Like fractional variation?
Oh, I don't know that offhand, okay. But I can get back to you. Yeah. So in other words, this sets a lower bound to the mass that you can actually reach in a laser. And actually, this lower bound also applies to both of the previous experiments. You can't go down much below 10 to the minus 13 eV or so. The other thing that you might worry is your mirrors might shift a little bit due to thermal noise. And it turns out that if you're probing GA gamma gammas of 10 to the minus 14 and above, you're still short noise limited. And if you start to have experiments that are more sensitive than this, then you need to start worrying about thermal noise. So our estimate is that it becomes thermal noise dominated somewhere around here. And so at this point, we still don't worry about that.
Are you assuming any squeezing?
No.
What is the finesse of the cavity?
Good. So the finesse of the cavity that we're going with here is about 10 to the 5. Okay, so there are two plots here. If you look at if you ignore this bottommost plot, then the upper plots here are all for a 2-meter cavity with a finesse given by 2 times 10 to the 5. The reason why we chose this finesse value is because Matt Evans is on the paper. He basically has mirrors that can do this, and they're just sitting around. So we took those mirror properties, which, you know, they have not been like specially designed for this experiment yet. But we just took those mirror properties and see how well we could do in terms of the limits.
Delta phi is what? The angle between them?
Yeah, so delta phi here is the phase shift that you get between orthogonal polarizations at each reflection. Sorry, at each pair of reflections. And so it turns out that if you adjust the mirrors so that the angle of incidence sweeps between 59 to about 65 degrees or so, you can generate a relative phase shift between the carrier signal of between 0 to about 30 degrees or so. Okay, so we think 65 degrees is fine. If you go above that, then the angle of incidence is very large, and so you might your beam spot on the mirror gets very large, and so we're not too comfortable with that. So we stop somewhere at about 65 degrees. But if you stay within this range, then you can generate some phase difference from about 0 to pi over 5. And that gets you up to a mass of about 1 over 5 times L. Yeah. OK. So then what we want to do is we want to take F over 5 steps. And the reason why we want it's over 5 is because we only go up to pi over 5. And then we're just going to step the mirrors slowly by f over 5 steps between those angle ranges. And at each step, you get a resonance corresponding to some axion mass. And then we integrate there for some amount of time. And this can cover the full mass range of about 10 to the minus 13 to 10 to the minus 7. And this corresponds to 1 over L, 1 over 5 L in particular. OK? So.
So have people measured, yep. Because here you're using linearly polarized light.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the stability of the polarization here? You're saying that it can be controlled.
Yeah, we claim that we can control it to be less than short noise up to a frequency of about 10 hertz.
Has this been demonstrated for lasers?
Because
usually I'm not sure how often they do with polarized light. So.
Yeah. I don't know if it's been demonstrated very well, but our LIGO author thinks that it's very possible. So the claim is that without doing anything, you're fine above like 10 to the 6 hertz.
Sure, because
yeah.
It's high frequency.
Yeah.
It gets up. Yeah. Now the question yeah. is what happens at lower frequency.
Yeah. Yeah. So you as you go lower and lower, you start thinking about laser technical noise. The claim is we make a claim that we can control it to be less than short noise down to about here. How good this claim is, I am not certain. Yeah.
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 Okay. Who was the best
lasers are linear reformers.
Are linear reformers?
All lasers.
Ah, okay, okay.
Yes.
So that means
you just cannot do like otherwise.
I see.
Like either material lasers or just cavity lasers. The different polarization, like coming from different, like single material.
What sets the axis of the polarization?
Like it's just like
the game medium.
Something.
Yeah.
And there's a y-axis which is predominantly amplifying, and like all lasers are linear polarized. To actually very high precision.
Yeah, but there's still a slight drift that we are aware of. Yeah.
Drift, right?
Yeah.
I mean, a single, for example, we can have example. So fraction. Yeah, that's why. I mean, that's why I would like fractional change. What is the delta phi that you're sensitive to? Like overall, what is the small? I guess.
For the laser. Yeah.
Yeah. How small of the shift in the linear polarization? How much, what's the smallest angle you can measure? How much can you tip off the polarization and measure?
So in some sense, this setup doesn't really care, right? Because you are just hoping to...
you have a carrier frequency. What I'm afraid of is...
Because in the end, what you're looking for is this thing, right? So
yeah, it's
you,
true.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is that if E carrier fluctuates by a little bit and you cannot control that angle, then it appears like a signal.
Yes, you're right.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I just want to have a number in my head that
yeah
that is like a reference point for this.
Good. I can't give you a number offhand, but I can try to get you one offline. Okay.
The solid light in your blood is you just scan through the various.
That's right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Where is it? I mean, at what mass does it break down? Have you actually gone into the region where you can't assume the coherence of the RCM field?
No. So it breaks down at one over 5L, and. 1 over L is still perfectly fine, right? Because the V of the axion is like 10 to the minus 3. So you're well within the range where the axion is spatially coherent. Yeah. OK. So we take, in this case, we take the integration time to be inversely proportional to the axion mass, which optimally, in some sense, covers this space. And so if we take a total time of 30 days, we can afford to integrate each point for an integration time of 35 times the axion coherence time. And this is the limit that we end up getting in purple. And each particular mirror configuration will give you this particular resonance, like this. OK? The 2-meter cavity, which I think is much more interesting because we essentially have all of the materials necessary to build a 2-meter cavity already. And so we could theoretically, you know, throw this together relatively quickly. And we could beat the current cast limits at least at the low mass end by about one or two orders of magnitude. And if we are more, going to be more ambitious, then we can throw it into a 40-meter cavity, which is available at one of the LIGO halls, I think. And
have that finesse, though?
Well, the finesse that we assume here is the current finesse of our mirrors.
For the 2-meter thing?
Yeah. So those are just like mirrors that the LIGO people have in their lab.
No, but the 40 meters is different, right?
Yeah, so the 40 meters, of course, is much more challenging. Your mirrors will probably have to be bigger.
Yeah. So I'm asking, so there's a 40-meter... Cavity, 40-meter cavity at Caltech, right? Test. So that one, what finesse does it have?
Like the mirrors?
What's the fitness of that cavity? Just to have some idea of how much people need to improve.
That's a really good question. I actually don't know what the current finesse is there. But from my sense, this number is not, it's not crazy.
I don't know what's crazy.
I know 10 to the 6 is crazy. Like 10 to the 6 is considered, so the usual benchmark that people have is like finesse 10 to the 6 peak cavity 1 megawatt.
Yeah, but those are usually for much smaller cavities. Are they for 40-meter cavities?
Yeah.
They're not for 40-meter
cavities,
not. Right?
Maybe not.
So they have demonstrated all sorts of, but the size of the cavity is much smaller.
Yeah.
So, I mean, maths on paper, but it would be nice to get a sense of what, you understand, like, quite why I'm asking, right?
Where we are now, like, what is actually possible now. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, it looks like the blue is where you are now. The question is, go to the brown, how much do you have to work?
That's a very good question.
Should depend mainly on the properties of the mirror, right?
Depends on,
to build larger mirrors.
Yeah, and also the spot size, thermal noise gets worse. Also, I mean, just making it bigger doesn't make it easier.
That is the complicated.
Yeah, LIGO right now is a few thousand, but it's also a kilometer size,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So from what 40 meters to like a kilometer, there's a difference.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
So, but the question is, where is it linear with a LIGO, for example?
No,
you understand?
No. Yes.
Right?
Yes. I understand.
So how
yeah.
The difficulty
good.
Go
good.
The
no.
Size?
This is a good question. And I will. Yeah, I will get back to you on that.
Okay.
I think that's a very good question. Yeah. Okay. So that's really all. Conclusion, you know, axions couple modes that are orthogonally polarized, separated by axion mass, and we've proposed an experiment called the ADBC experiment, and hopefully that's going to significantly improve our sensitivity and extends the mass reach compared to earlier proposals. Okay, that's all. Thank you.
We are like 20 minutes over.
Oh god, sorry, I didn't even notice.
No,
yeah.
It's not your fault.
Yeah.
And thank you again.
Yeah, thank you.